Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unscheduled trip to Ukraine by the leaders of Germany and France to confer with the Secretary of State and Ukraine's president before going on to Moscow to offer a peace plan to Vladimir Putin. A leading international expert on contemporary Ukraine at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta, Taras Kuzio, joins us. He is the author of the new book, Ukraine, Democratization, Corruption, and the New Russian Imperialism. And we will discuss his article at the Financial Times, Arm Ukraine and Force Putin Back to the Negotiating Table, as well as the apparent good cop, bad cop strategy underway to get Putin to the negotiating table before the U.S. and NATO moves to arm Ukraine to defend itself in a war where Russia has already taken Crimea and a large area of Ukraine with the intervention of thousands of Russian troops with advanced military equipment in a blatant invasion that the ill-equipped and poorly trained Ukrainian military cannot match. Then we'll go to the UK to speak with Idris Ahmad, a London-based writer and political sociologist who is a lecturer in journalism at the University of Stirling, Scotland, and the author of the new book just out, The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. We will discuss the history of the war party of neoconservatives behind the Iraq debacle, who manufactured an unnecessary and disastrously counterproductive war, the cost and consequences of which continue to this day. We'll examine why the architects of this endless tragedy have never been held to account and how they may come back as a part of a President Hillary Clinton foreign policy team or in another Bush administration, assuming there is sufficient amnesia in America to elect as their next president the brother of the decider who took America headfirst into one of its greatest economic, military, and diplomatic catastrophes in history. And joining us now is Taras Kuzio, who's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta, and a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is Ukraine, Democratization, Corruption, and the New Russian Imperialism. And he has an op-ed at the Financial Times, Arm Ukraine and Force Putin Back to the Negotiating Table. Welcome to Background Briefing, Taras Kuzio.
Hi.
And it does appear that there is a sort of coordinated strategy underway where you have the French Prime Minister, or the French President Hollande, and the German Chancellor Angela Merkel meeting in Ukraine at the same time that U.S. Secretary of State Kerry is there, and then the German and French leader are then going on to Moscow on Friday to meet with Putin to offer a new peace plan. So do you see this as a kind of good cop, bad cop strategy in the sense that if Putin doesn't agree to a new peace talks, and presumably this time at least they'll have the condition that he take them at least mildly seriously, unlike the other peace agreement, the so-called Minsk Accords back in September. And if he doesn't agree to that, then that would then lead the way to a possible arming of Ukraine by the West.
Well, certainly it would seem that the Europeans, or the West Europeans in particular, who don't really favor sending arms to Ukraine, are playing the role of the good cop, with Secretary of State Kerry threatening Vladimir Putin that if he doesn't sign up to new proposals — we don't know what the proposals are yet — then some U.S., not only U.S., but some U.S. weapons will defensive weapons will be sent to Ukraine. There are probably three or four other NATO members who also would be interested in following the U.S., Canada, Britain, and Poland in particular, but they are waiting really for the U.S. to cross that road first, to set the example, and then they would follow suit. Now, there are other possible threats as well, which are going to be made to worsen and deepen the economic and financial sanctions against Russia. There have been calls to move these sanctions down the road of what have been held against Iran the last few years. So, for example, to take Russia out of the SWIFT system, which is the international payment systems for credit cards and for banks. This would have a severe impact on Russia's financial economic situation, and that is one option, for example, which is proposed by the newspaper The Guardian in Britain today as well. So there are a range of options. The problem we have is that nobody believes a word that Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov say, because they did sign up, after all, to the Minsk Accords in September. But they haven't implemented a single one of these articles. And they continue to lie and say that the Russian forces and Russian equipment are not in eastern Ukraine. So there's very little trust either amongst Western countries or amongst the Ukrainians. And even the countries such as Germany, who don't really want arms to go to Ukraine, even their leaders have actually exasperated by the continued lying coming out of Moscow.
And meanwhile, 5,500 Ukrainians, civilians have died and 1.2 million have been displaced. This is a real war in Europe. And for the life of me, I don't understand why the political left continues to make excuses for Putin. There is no evidence whatsoever that Ukraine has invaded Russia. It hasn't taken chunks of Russia. It hasn't annexed a whole province of Russia. It hasn't invaded a whole chunk of Russia. It has killed thousands of people. What more evidence do people need that this is clearly one-sided aggression? And the idea that somehow Ukraine is run by fascists. I mean, my understanding of the definition of fascism is that it's a combination of state political power and corporate power, and that is exactly what you have under Putin's gangster state in Russia, run by the Siloviki. They are by definition fascists because they're a combination of oligarchs and political officials running the country who are interchangeable.
Well, you're right that it's not just the far left, but it's also the far right, which in the U.S. is less influential than in Europe. But the far left and the far right both are anti-American, both are anti-NATO, and they have a very bizarre alliance with Vladimir Putin. They've gone to Crimea and to eastern Ukraine to support his so-called referendums there and local elections. The far right and the far left both hate the European Union, and therefore they are in bed with Vladimir Putin on this bizarre alliance against the Ukrainian authorities. Ukraine held two democratic elections last year, which were defined as free and fair by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the European Union, and Council of Europe. Russia hasn't held free elections for donkey's years. The definition of what would we understand in political science terminology to be a fascist state is, of course, far more akin to Vladimir Putin's regime, which is sort of a very machismo, with him parading around without his shirt on, shooting wild animals, the praise of the leader, praise of Russian imperial and nationalist heroes. That is something far more to do with Russia than with Ukraine. The far right in Ukraine received 2% in the last parliamentary elections, and they don't have any influence in the parliament. One has to understand that the term fascist has been misused, particularly by the left, for decades, and it basically just means anybody who disagrees with you. It doesn't actually mean it's not the political science definition of what is fascist, because that is certainly something very different to what is taking place in Ukraine. Even on the question of national minorities, the Council of Europe and other organizations have given Ukraine a clean bill of health. Whereas just take a look at what's happening to the Tatars in the Crimea. They are now suffering their worst period of time of repression since the 1940s when they were deported to Siberia and Central Asia. So yes, this is sadly a misuse of the term, and it does beg a belief why one doesn't get a more clear understanding that this is nothing but, as Secretary of State Kerry today said in Kiev, this is blatant Russian aggression against a neighboring country in defiance of international law, UN charter, and various agreements signed between Russia and Ukraine.
Again, I'm speaking with Taras Kuzia, who's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta, and a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is Ukraine, Democratization, Corruption, and the New Russian Imperialism. And he has an op-ed at the Financial Times, Arm Ukraine and Force Putin Back to the Negotiating Table. And clearly, when the incredibly crooked leader of Ukraine was ousted by the people, and he was a major kleptocrat, and he fled to Russia, that clearly alarmed Putin, and perhaps he saw a similar fate to him if the people rise up. And he is offering a criminal rule. That's what this guy was, and that's what he's trying to reinstate with these thugs that he's unleashed in eastern Ukraine. So I imagine that, you know, the choice is pretty stark. You either try and, side with Europe and European values, or you just submit to Russian thuggery. And at a certain point, because the Ukrainian military is ill-equipped and poorly trained, it's not. How much longer can they hold out? I mean, when this rebel leader claims that when he puts out a call for 100,000 troops, there's already about 10,000 Russian troops in there now. We know where the other 90,000 will come from. Is there a possibility that Ukraine can simply be conquered militarily? Or would Putin just like to take a big chunk of it, force a kind of Chechen-like solution on the place where you'd essentially have a bloc that would have veto power over over Ukrainian parliament?
Well, the Ukrainians are holding their ground up to a certain extent, but of course the volume and the sophistication of the military equipment coming in from Russia is mind-boggling. This is being tracked by a variety of satellite think tanks, Western intelligence agencies. There are many videos and photographs on the internet that can be found of that. There's certainly no question about proof. This kind of equipment is not stolen from the Ukrainians or bought in local hardware stores in Donetsk. It is brought in from Russia. Now, the question is, to what degree is Russia willing to commit its forces? It's losing a lot of men on the ground. The rate of casualties that Russia is inflicting upon itself, even, is higher than what it got in Afghanistan. There, Russia lost 15,000 over 10 years. Russia's already lost in less than a year in Ukraine something in the region of 3,000 to 4,000 troops. Because it's done a lot of the brunt of the fighting rather than the separatists. I don't think the separatists can recruit 100,000 people. That's just bravado. And if it did claim it had, probably half or more of those would be from Russia. They wouldn't be local people. But certainly the separatist conflict would fizzle out and the Ukrainians would defeat the separatists as they were about to in August if it wasn't being backed externally by Russia. And so from that point of view, it is an artificial conflict. And it is, as you say, it's something that is partly a product of Western, in particular European, disbelief in actually trying to get their heads around who they're dealing with. Karen Dawisha, an academic on the University of Maryland, has just published a book on Vladimir Putin's Russia. Her British publishers, Cambridge University Press, had to annul the book contract because of legal threats from Russia, so she published it in the U.S. or this greater freedom. And her entire book is devoted to the rise of this mafia state in Russia. She documents it through Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg in the 1990s and to this present day. So it, on the one hand, it's similar in the sense of the 1930s in that there Hitler used the excuse of defending German speakers in neighboring states to launch invasions, and here Putin is using the excuse of so-called threats to Russian speakers in neighboring states. But at the same time, Hitler's regime wasn't a mafia state in the sense of being linked to organized crime, and it also didn't have nuclear weapons. So here we have three things rolled into one. We have a fascist state, we have a mafia state, and a nuclear power. This makes it and should make us even more concerned as to what Putin and Russia are up to. But it would seem at times that the Europeans really don't want to see what's really in front of them. They don't want to see the wood for the trees. And it actually makes me wonder whether the European Union really needs a foreign policy, because they simply just don't get it. They just don't want to get their heads around what they're dealing with here in Moscow.
Well, of course, that all gives a lie to Putin's claim that NATO is somehow manipulating this whole situation. You know, the Europeans just simply don't want to get involved, and NATO is a paper tiger to begin with. There wasn't up until recently any tanks, American equipment in Europe, and there's a handful now. So it's not as if there's an easy solution here. And you know, even the NATO commander they're reluctant to escalate this situation, but if they don't understand that they're dealing with a thug, then I don't know what we can do. I just don't, at this point, you know, it frustrates me that people seem to still give Putin a pass. And, you know, you can criticize the NATO expansion eastward of being counterproductive and going against the wishes of Gorbachev. And even Henry Kissinger has said that the West has not considered Russia's security interests sufficiently. But those things aren't mutually exclusive with the fact that Russia is a gangster state run by a very brutal and cynical criminal.
Well, yes, the NATO assumed that there would be a Cold War dividend, that they had won the Cold War, and therefore they could reduce military and security spending. And in fact, only four countries who are members of NATO, so four out of 27, actually spend the 2% of their GDP on defense as per NATO guidelines. And therefore, there's, in very many ways, the shock value that, hey, we have to now divert resources, which are pretty scarce in this day and age, because many countries are still recovering from 2008-2009, away from social, economic, educational resources towards defense and security. There's also, I think, publicly there's an unwillingness to maybe face what's in the public domain, what they're dealing with in Moscow. But privately, there's obviously, I think, very strong suspicion that Western governments knew who they were dealing with. And there are two examples of that. We have the Litvinenko now investigation reopened in London, the murder of this Russian exile in 2006 by, according to the documents shown in the British court, murdered on the orders of the Russian leadership. So already in 2006, British intelligence and therefore British government, which must have shared that intelligence with its European and American allies, they knew that Vladimir Putin's regime was behind this nuclear assassination in London. And secondly, we know from the U.S. diplomatic cables that were leaked, the so-called WikiLeaks, that inside cables, the U.S. was already talking about Russia as a mafia state as early as 2010. So we have an internal, real picture of Russia portrayed in intelligence documents, cables from Moscow and from Kiev. But we have the public face, which is trying to pretend that Russia's become a cuddly teddy bear, and hence Russia was kept in the G7 and G8 when it had no real right to be there as a dictatorship and as an authoritarian state. I mean, why should Russia be there? If we're going to invite Russia into the G7, why not invite China and other authoritarian regimes? Why not invite the democracy that India is, for example, into the G7? So there were these attempts at trying to pretend that the grizzly bear had become a cuddly teddy bear, when in fact, privately, Western governments really knew that this regime was a mafia state, killing its own people, but they didn't really want to talk about this publicly. I think there's one final thing here that we should raise as well, because this issue is now becoming important in Ukraine, the whole question of war crimes. Russian and separatist forces, and this is documented on various videos on YouTube, have been committing war crimes against Ukrainian prisoners of war. They've paraded them in the streets. They've beaten them. Some have been executed summarily. Some towns have been completely flattened by Russian and separatist forces. This all amounts to war crimes. But the big question in this day and age is, can a nuclear power like Russia, can its leaders be held to account for war crimes? Because in the past, Russia's leaders have not been held to account. They've got off the hook. Slobodan Milosevic and his ilk were sent to The Hague to stand trial. But Russia, what it undertook in Chechnya in 2000-2001, under Vladimir Putin, where it destroyed the city of Grozny, 100,000 people were killed. That was on a par with what happened in Bosnia, but nobody ever was held to account because, of course, Russia is a nuclear power and it has a seat on the UN Security Council. So, again, we have a double standards here. Where why can a nuclear power like Russia get away with war crimes? And will it be allowed to get away with those war crimes now in eastern Ukraine?
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Taras Kuzio.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Taras Kuzio, who's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta, and a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is Ukraine, Democratization, Corruption, and the New Russian Imperialism. And he has an op-ed at the Financial Times, Arm Ukraine and Force Putin Back to the Negotiating Table. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to London to speak with Idris Ahmad, the author of the new book, The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation. What is my sin? When will my ship come in? First I ask. But where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I stopped opening doors, finally finding the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual friend.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is Idris Ahmad, who is a political sociologist and lecturer in journalism at the University of Stirling in Scotland. His articles and essays have appeared in The Atlantic, The New Republic, Al Jazeera, The National, Le Monde Diplomatique, Guernica, Adbusters, IPS News, Political Insight, and The London Review of Books. He has also appeared as a political analyst on the BBC and edits the pulsemedia.org blog, and is the author of the new book just out, The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Idris Ahmad.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And your book couldn't be more important and more timely, Idris, simply because we are, it looks like we're heading into a period of, we are in a period of enormous political amnesia here in the United States. And whichever of the most likely presidential candidates are elected in 2016, Hillary Clinton is likely to bring back the neocons, as many fear, and George Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, would be the other alternative. So if he's elected, then the Bushes are back in power, and the American people have entirely forgotten the greatest political tragedy in modern history.
Well, I think certainly there has been a big, I would say that there has been a real sort of amnesia over here, because obviously the events are not too far in the distant past. But what has happened is that there is almost like a rush to erase this part of history. And in a sense, what has happened is right now, with everything happening in the region, so it has made it more convenient. Because the threat that Bush had supposedly gone out to confront has now been manufactured. The invasion created the threat that Bush said that he was going out to destroy. So right now, the Middle East does have issues which seem to make, which give an opportunity to all these people, the original instigators of the war, to claim that they had it right in the first place.
So, in other words, they've created their own nemesis, and now, rather than get blamed for the obvious that they opened up a can of worms that has created untold destruction and continues to do so in the Middle East, they're actually now, ironically, you're saying that the monster that they created is the justification that they gave back at the beginning of the war, which, of course, was completely phony.
Well, of course. I mean, and what has happened also is that I think in Washington, the momentum that they had created, which has continued, and consequence of that has been that even when there was a change in policy, even when there was a shift away from the new conservative point of view, so that itself meant that there was a new form of violations which were introduced. So Obama's drone war came out as a reaction to the neocons' massive engagements. So this was, in this case, the costs were deferred onto the targeted populations. So the consequence of that is that it's in short term, it works very well. It's tactically successful. But strategically, it has enormous costs, which will be borne by either future generations or even in the immediate future, we might be we are already seeing blowback of various kinds. And so it has consequences. And I don't think that even the alternative to the neocons in Washington has been that savory. It's just as destructive. I think that the approach, the conviction that because the United States has this enormous military power, that somehow it has to use it, or it has the right to use it. It that seems to have stayed with the even with the current policymakers.
And again, I'm speaking with Idris Ahmad, who is a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He's a lecturer in journalism at the University of Stirling in Scotland. And his latest book just out is The Road to Iraq: The Making of a Neoconservative War. So, Idris, the book really is an important addition to this much-needed debate because, as I say, this is worse than Dracula. I don't know why you can't kill off the neocons, because everything they've said has blown up in our faces and cost this country so dearly, both in treasure and reputation, and has got a whole region of the world roiling in turmoil and has riled up over a billion Muslims around the world. So let's talk about who were the war party then? Who are these people? Because my understanding, since I've known some of them, like Richard Perle, over the years, my sense is, Perle, in the case, he came out of Scoop Jackson, the Democrat who was often referred to as the senator from Boeing, he represented Washington. I always thought of these guys, and Wolfowitz too, because I worked against Wolfowitz during the Cold War when he was in charge of the Committee on the Present Danger, made a film that was the opponent of the one that they made to try and scare up this new Cold War with the Soviet Union under Ronald Reagan and justify the military buildup based on the idea that the Russians had all of these bigger missiles and all of this nonsense that they purveyed. But in any case, the point I wanted to make is that I've always seen them as shills for the military-industrial complex. How do you see them?
Well, certainly they are partly that. In fact, before Pearl, one of their mentors, the guy who actually managed to place them inside the Scoop Jackson office, was a fellow called Albert Wolfstetter. And back during the 50s and 60s, he was a crucial figure who was doing pretty much the same thing. In fact, he was setting the precedents that the neocons would later follow. So he was in the contest between, for example, Kennedy and when Kennedy came to power. So he ran on this platform when he first defeated Nixon. He ran on this platform in which he claimed that there was a missile gap between the U.S. and Soviet Union. And obviously all of these claims were based on very dubious evidence. And but what they did is that these claims, which had been discarded by the CIA, by the intelligence agency, so they picked those up and leaked it to the press and then amplified them. And Kennedy used that as one of the attack points that the Republican government hasn't had allowed this missile gap to develop. So Wolfowitz was a key figure in that. Wolfowitz and a fellow called Paul Nitzer. But what happened later on is that Wolfowitz then bequeathed his politics and also his access to the higher echelons of power to primarily to Pearl, but then Wolfowitz was also one of his proteges, and then also there was Ahmad Chalabi was one of his proteges, and then you had people like Zalmay Khalilzad, although Zalmay Khalilzad is a sort of minor figure in this whole constellation. But mainly you are looking at people like Pearl, Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, and Michael Ledeen, who go on to play significant roles in the administration 1970s on. And one of the things that they did is that in the 70s, when there was the detente with Russia, that there was the possibility of, this was just after the Vietnam War had finished and the United States was just trying to recover. And Nixon had started the whole detente policy, Nixon and Kissinger both. And the main opponents of that were, one, the Israel lobby, and on the other hand, you had the military-industrial complex, because both were afraid that if there was a reduction in arms spending, so it's going to cost their constituencies. So what they did is that at this time, they joined hands, and that's where the nexus emerged, the neocon nexus, which emerged as a kind of which linked the Israel lobby with the arms industry. And both had an interest in retaining the massive arms spending. And that's where these people became very much as lobbyists for the military-industrial complex and consequently also for the Israel lobby.
Well, I've never understood, though, how the Israelis got aboard the neocon agenda to go to war against Iraq. Superficially, of course, the war temporarily got rid of the Iraqi army, which was one of the biggest mistakes that the neocons made, demobilizing the army, which would otherwise have kept the peace and secured the borders. Instead, you ended up with about 450,000 armed and angry, unemployed men. That was one of the more extraordinary blunders of the neocons. So, you know, when you have people like the former British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw remarking that Scooter Libby, who was Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Jack Straw saying that it's a toss-up whether Libby is working for the Israelis or the Americans on any given day. I've talked to a number of Israelis, like the Israeli historian Martin Van Creewald, who made the observation that the Iraq War was the biggest strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus sent his legions into Germany in 9 AD. So what part of Israel are they working for, and how has Israel in any way benefited from this?
Well, once again, Israel is not unified on this, because inside Israel, there were different perspectives, including even the Mossad wasn't very keen on this war. And so what happened is that just as in the U.S., the neocons created ad hoc committees to bypass the intelligence agencies. So same thing happened in Israel as well, because Sharon created offices in his own, these ad hoc committees in his own office, through which intelligence was relayed to the U.S. So this didn't have the approval of the whole Israeli security establishment. Now, the thing is that Israel had an interest, a different kind of interest. It's just the usual aggressive realist position that they wanted all the surrounding states to be weakened so that they remain the predominant power. And the state, initially, in the 80s, they used to be most concerned about was Iraq and Iran and also Syria. But what happened is that with Iraq weakened after 1991, their focus had shifted to Iran. So their key focus had remained Iran. Now, the only thing was that the neocons knew that Iran would be a very hard sell, whereas Iraq was doable because there was already considerable hostility towards Iraq, and also it could be implicated more easily. And the plan that they presented, so one of Cheney's key Middle East advisors was this fellow called David Wurmser. So he became their main sort of theorist on Iraq. So he wrote this book called Tyranny's Ally, and then he wrote these two very important documents. One of them is called A Clean Break, and another one was a follow-up that they wrote for the Israeli government in the mid-90s. And in which they prescribed that the same thing, that Israel really needs to make sure that its neighborhood is secure. And the way to do it is that it should weaken the surrounding states. So Iraq was named as a target, and also Syria and Iran. And what they proposed, this was the document had also the signatures. It carried the signatures of Richard Perle and Douglas Feith as well. So what they proposed to the Israeli government, this was when Netanyahu had first come to power, was that Israel itself couldn't get engaged so far afield, I mean, Iraq and Iran and Syria. So what they said was that Israel had to, in a sense, recruit the services of the United States to neutralize its enemies. Now, 5 years later, these same guys then ended up in the Bush administration, and David Wurmser ended up as the chief Middle East advisor for Dick Cheney.
Who, by the way, had a bigger National Security Council than most previous American presidents had, and
indeed,
effectively,
yes. And he also
ran the White House. And under Bush had no clue that Cheney was actually the president.
Yes, and in the second term,
exactly.
Bush
woke up.
Seized some of the control back, but in the first administration, Cheney was the dominant force. And so, what happened is that. David Wurmser's argument was that Iran couldn't be taken on directly because in the U.S. it will be a very hard sell, that nobody could be persuaded. So what can be done, however, is that if Iraq is neutralized and a friendly Shia power is placed over there, so what that can be done, that can be used to roll back the theocracy, because there's a schism between the Iranian and the Iraqi Shias. There is this concept called Vilayat-e-Faqih, which was introduced by Khomeini, the Iranian spiritual leader, the leader of the Iranian revolution. But this isn't accepted by most Iraqi Shia. In fact, the key figure in Iraq, the most highest authority, is Ayatollah Sistani. And Sistani is not a subscriber to the Vilayat-e-Faqih concept. So the idea that neocons had was that they can use their position in Iraq to destabilize not only Iran, but also Saudi Arabia, where the oil-rich regions of Saudi Arabia are also mainly Shia. So that was the plan, that they can use the position inside Iraq to also weaken the other enemies.
Well, the thing that though is extraordinary, though, Idris Ahmad, again, the author of the new book just out, The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War, the thing that I find extraordinary is that for all of their ideology, for all of their incredible political organizations, and the neocons are very skillful in using the media. And that was one of the tragedies in the lead up to the Iraq war. Brent Scowcroft, who wrote the op-ed warning about what a disaster the Iraq war would be, they went after him, and he just didn't want to go on television and be screamed at by these jackals like Cliff May and company. So they know how to work the media, but they are amazing incompetents, and they're completely idiotic in executing their ideology. For example, their hero, Ahmad Chalabi, was an Iranian agent all along, and he actually gave the Iranians information that the National Security Agency had broken the Iranian diplomatic code and were reading their mail. The guy, as far as the damage he's done to America, ought to be shot. And these fools that thought he'd be the new Nelson Mandela of Iraq ought to be lined up against a wall with him. I mean, that's the part of it that I don't understand, is how could they be so wrong, always, consistently, and yet still be a political force in Washington?
Well, I think in Washington, unfortunately, as long as you maintain a very aggressive stance, so your such follies can be very easily forgiven. If you look at it in media, many of the people who opposed the war, they came and went, but the people who were all for the war, they never lost their jobs. I mean, in fact, they went on to very lucrative careers, and all of them are still around. So I don't think that in Washington that system of failure has ever carried any kind of cost. And with the neocons especially, what has happened is that I must also say that the neocons have had it easy for the simple reason that their opponents are also, they aren't much of an improvement on them. So, I mean, take right now the, in the book that I'm one of the things that I mentioned is that one of the reasons why the neocons had such an easy task getting into positions of power and even forming alliances with liberal internationalists was that during the 1990s, the realist camp, which used to be dominant, you know, the Scowcrofts and all, they used to be dominant. And when situations like Bosnia emerged, so their response to everything was indifference. And that didn't go down well in a world, especially at a time when there was a more sense, I mean, this is after the fall of the Berlin Wall, so there was a more sense of being part of a global community. So Bosnia was something that I think weighed on many people's consciences. And there, the neocons had a much better position than the realists, because the neocons at that time at least recognized that this is something that requires international action. So they used that credibility that they had gained during the 90s. So when they come to power, so they tried to sell Iraq in a similar way, except the difference was that in Iraq, there was no imminent humanitarian crisis. What they did is that you saw that how many humanitarian interventionists joined forces with them. And one of the reasons was because they tried to sell it as if this is some kind of a Bosnia-like situation, and which it wasn't. Because in Iraq, the thing was that there was the worst crimes of Saddam Hussein were more than 10 years behind him. And the biggest killer at the time was the sanctions regime, which was killing a whole lot of people every month. So Iraq's problems were different. But what has happened with neocons is that these people, they went in without regard for the consequences. And as a result, what has happened is that it has cost the U.S. big time. But because they use the rhetoric of American nationalism, they use the rhetoric of American primacy. So if you point out their mistakes, so it becomes tantamount to saying that somehow you're questioning American primacy or you're questioning somehow America's good fate. And so that's how they've played the rhetoric rather well. In Washington, if you're questioning their policies, you're somehow questioning the good fate of the United States, or you're even worse, that you are somehow questioning the troops and you're their sacrifices. And that's why even somebody like Barack Obama, when he when he was repudiating the war, so he really spoke about that how that we had gone in with all great intentions. So he had to play that up. And which obviously wasn't really, that wasn't really obvious that there were good intentions. In fact, if you spoke, if you look at Cheney and if you look at Rumsfeld, even in their books, they're very forthright in their biographies. Both of them are very forthright. In fact, Rumsfeld laughs at the whole notion that we had to go in for democracy promotion or human rights. And both of them were quite clear that they were going in to set an example. Shock and awe, that's what they were all about.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Idris Ahmad.
I'm your masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind discs. I just don't want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And we're continuing the conversation with Idris Ahmad, the author of the brand new book just out, The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. And this book could not be more important and more timely because the neoconservatives will be coming back. We live in a country with total political amnesia. It's quite possible the American people will elect Jeb Bush in 2016 as president of the United States, and everything that his brother did will be entirely forgotten, even though the agony lives on with the so-called Islamic State today as a direct byproduct of this catastrophic intervention in Iraq. And of course, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, there are rumors that she is smitten with a number of key neoconservatives, and they may well come back in a Hillary Clinton administration. So they are truly an amazing group who have totally left wreck and ruin on the world stage, but continue to be rewarded with attention. And I guess in a way, you can also tie into this in terms of the current situation, the situation vis-a-vis Netanyahu, who is a kind of neoconservative hero. Here he is trying to sabotage the possibility of a deal with Iran, and the only hope is that his arrogance and bluster and the use of a Israel's ambassador to the United States, who helped engineer this trip to Washington, might blow up in their face. But again, the brazenness of how they really see themselves as the real legitimate rulers and will conduct kind of guerrilla warfare against who's ever in the White House that they disagree with, you know, with no holds barred.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable. And I think that also the fact of the matter is that one of the power also derives from, you know, it's actually a function of the domestic balance of power. The Israel lobby still remains a significant force, although I must say that Obama in this last year has really defied the lobby on several occasions, finally. And I think that for that reason, their power is not the same as it used to be. And the other thing that has happened is that this congressional trip, I hope that it happens, because I think that it's going to really, it's going to be a very stark reminder for a lot of people that the agenda that Netanyahu is pushing and also his domestic supporters they are pushing is very much at odds with American interests. At least one half of America will recognize that, because until now they have enjoyed, I mean, the neoconservatives as well as the Israel lobby have enjoyed bipartisan support. But that's one of the reasons why even supporters of Israel inside the United States are not entirely enthusiastic about Netanyahu's visit to the Congress, because it's a very brazen, direct confrontation with the United States president. And I think that it's also a direct intervention in U.S. politics. So this obviously is going to have consequences. I don't think it will be seen in a positive light by most Americans.
So, Idris Ahmad, the new book just out, The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. And this is a war that continues to this day. The war that is going on now in the Middle East is a direct consequence of the intervention by the Bush-Cheney administration, at the essentially the intellectual authors of which were the neoconservatives. And in your new book, of course, you also talk about liberal interventionists and how, in many ways, the liberals still to this day in America get it wrong. You have a chapter titled Black Gold and Red Herrings, the idea that's so often put forth that it was all about oil. Well, that's nonsense, because the U.S. didn't end up getting any oil, or very little to nothing. It's all about, you know, the Naomi Klein idea of a crisis capitalism, that somehow it was all about free markets. She conflates neoconservatism with neoliberalism. You know, so just walk us through that sort of confusion on the left about what the Iraq War really, well, we don't know what it was about, because the architects have never really explained it adequately, but we sure as hell know what the consequences are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my book tried to address that. I tried to explain what the war was about, but I begin by showing what the war wasn't about. And obviously, the most among opponents of the war, the most popular theory was that this is just a war for oil. Now, the only problem with that theory was that if you looked at all of the 1990s, the oil companies and even Cheney, they had spent all of the 90s lobbying for sanctions to be lifted from Iraq. They were keen to go and do business. In fact, in the mid-90s, there was a big confrontation between American businesses, all the major Fortune 500 companies, the Chamber of Commerce, and all of these multinationals on one hand, and on the other hand, the Israel lobby, AIPAC. The confrontation was over the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, because all the U.S. companies, the major companies, were opposed to the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act. It was only being supported by AIPAC and the neoconservatives. And in the end, in fact, even the legislation itself was drafted by a fellow called Steve Weissman, who was one of the Steve Rosen. He was one of the executives at AIPAC. So what happened is that this legislation, it was passed. So the lobby basically triumphed over American businesses, and the American businesses were outraged, including Cheney, who gave many speeches in which he denounced the sanctions-happy policy of the United States. So now, in the lead-up to the war, Saddam Hussein made several overtures. You know, in the year before the war, he made several overtures offering the United States, because he wanted to keep his seat, and he was offering the United States that if you are after the oil, you can come and have it. You can have monopoly control as long as he gets to retain his seat. So he was making several concessions, but they were all rejected. That's because the oil wasn't the driving motive over there. Because one of the things which is misunderstood by a lot of analysts is that the United States has, when it's concerned, it has a very different way of dealing with it. Back in the 1940s, it made this decision that Saudi Arabia has all this enormous oil, and for that reason, United States has to maintain good links with Saudi Arabia. And they decided that we must never interfere in the internal politics, however benighted it might be, however obscurantist their leadership might be. We must not jeopardize this relationship. And as you can see, they bend over backwards to accommodate the Saudis. So they don't go and invade countries to get the oil. They do it through negotiations, because invasion creates consequences. It creates instability, which the U.S. policy throughout the post-war years had been all about maintaining stability, even if it meant allying with all kinds of dictators. That's why there was once an alliance with Saddam Hussein too, and there's the alliance with Saudi Arabia and all the Gulf potentates. So what has happened is that in Iraq, that wasn't the motive. And it's obvious also from what happened afterwards, because already in 2006, when the U.S. had the highest number of troops present in Iraq, already at that time, Iraqi government started reviving its oil contracts with Russia and with China. And then in 2009, when it gave its first major contracts, so they gave 10 contracts, all of them went to the biggest ones went to the Norwegians, the French, the Russians, and the Chinese. Only one out of the 10, and that's a minor one, went to an American company. Even that is part of a consortium with other foreign companies. So if it was if the United States was after oil, so with all its troops present in Iraq, it could have easily secured it. But that's what, not what it was about, because the United States, if it wanted the oil, it could have had it without the war.
So in the last few minutes, Idris, tell me about, I understand the incredible value of this book because, you know, as I mentioned, you know, I'd worked against Paul Wolfowitz when he was the head of the Committee on the Present Danger back before Reagan became president. And I've also, I knew Albert Wolstelic very well. And so I understand this world. And Michael Ledeen that you mentioned, he threatened to sue me because I revealed on my radio program in an interview with a former senior CIA official that the forgeries of the so-called yellow cake papers, the reason that was given for needing to intervene in Iraq because Iraq was allegedly buying uranium from Niger, this led to the outing of a CIA officer, Valerie Plame. But nobody in the press was looking at the actual who did the forgeries of these documents. And it was revealed in the interview that I did that the forgeries were done here in the United States. And I asked who did them. The former CIA officer, a guy called Vince Genestero, said, well, I'm not at liberty to say. And I said, well, if I said the word Michael Ledeen, what would you say? And he said, well, you'd be very close. And that prompted Michael Ledeen to threaten to sue me. So, you know, I have a pretty good handle on who these people are, but I just cannot believe that they can come back after the damage they've done, either under Hillary Clinton or that this country could elect the brother of President George W. Bush, who created this extraordinary, devastating mess that continues to this day.
Well, I think one of the unfortunate developments that has happened over the past 30 or so years is that the U.S. national security establishment has been pretty much colonized by the neoconservatives. So that means that regardless of which party comes, it usually comes with its own cohort of neoconservatives. And same thing is likely to happen again. Even when right now, I mean, you saw that when last time when Hillary Clinton was running for office back in 2008, so when she was asked about Iran, she actually threatened to obliterate Iran. That's the word that she had used. Now, obviously, she was doing that because she was playing to a neocon gallery. And the problem with that is that then at election time, all of these people are going to be running after the same money, the same Sheldon Adelsons, the same Koch brothers, and the same Lester Crowns on the Democratic side. So what happens is that they think that in order to have that money, they have to make these concessions. So they are going to make big statements. They are going to make aggressive statements against the rest of the world, and obviously they're going to any kind of possibility of a detente with Iran, they're going to oppose that. And negotiations are generally things that they're going to shun. So that is a very damaging legacy of the fact that basically the U.S. has abdicated this national security thinking to these people, that it has basically allowed the neoconservatives to claim the whole national security discourse.
Well, Idris Ahmad, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Idris Ahmad, who's a London-based writer with a doctorate in sociology and a focus on international conflicts. He's a lecturer in journalism at the University of Stirling in Scotland, and he's the author of the new book just out, The Road to Iraq, The Making of a Neoconservative War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.